So, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, social time. So, welcome again back to the lecture on social computing. So, today we're probably going to finish our considerations with respect to, quantities that we're able to characterize real-world social networks. And, maybe we can start with the considerations with respect to social networks in time and space. And the rest of the program will be social signal processing and a little bit of game theory. And maybe in the end, we'll take a look at some graph visualization if we have enough time. So as for the schedule, what I intend to do, and please indicate if that's not so great of an idea, is this is a 3-hour lecture, which means that we are supposed to, in theory, leave out every second Wednesday, right? So, and I intend to not really do more lecture hours than I'm entitled to do, right? Because that would be not very friendly and, in fact, illegal. However, I think a good way to proceed will be that we will take all the Wednesdays we have until, let's say, the third week in June. So for 2 more weeks, full power. And then the lecture is over, right? And then I'll do 1 more question hour before the actual exam so that you can keep back up. So we'll discuss everything. And I'll do 1 separate question hours before the repeat exam in October, right? So that'll give you enough time to finish the lab course. It'll give you enough time to prepare for other things, right? So I think that's a good strategy to keep on doing the pace with every Wednesday until we're done and leave out the last 2.5 weeks of the semester completely free with respect to social computing. So who thinks that's not so good of an idea? Hands up. Who thinks that it is actually a good idea? Okay, so we'll do that, and which means that tomorrow we'll also be having lecture as well as next week and the third week, and then I think we should be pretty much done, right? Maybe, yeah, well, good. So that's that. So we left off last time. What did we do? We discussed a lot of measures for characterizing large real-world social networks. Among them were things such as clustering coefficient, mean average path length, existence of a giant component, and other things. And I'm going to repeat the stuff with the giant component today. And, these were, let's call them descriptive statistics to describe real-world social networks in total. However, what's also often the case is that you compare the properties of a given social network with respect to an analogon in the world of random graphs. So you construct a random graph and compare its properties with the properties of the real-world network. Why do we do this? The answer is we exactly know how we constructed the random graph, right? So if you want to understand, let's say, why social networks have a certain clustering structure, one idea would be to construct a random graph with as many nodes and edges, knowing exactly how you did that, right? So drawing this graph out of an ensemble of possible graphs, and then describing its properties. And if those coincide within a certain level of accuracy, you might say, well, I understood what's going on, right? So that's the same way or some comparable way of understanding things as in physics, for example, right? So you make a controlled experiment, that is, you try to repeat nature's constructing principles, and if you find a well enough coincidence with what you observe out there, then you say, I understood the process up to a certain degree of, exactness or whatever. Now, one especially simple random graph model was the Poisson random graph, right? So you take n nodes and you instantiate each possible edge between any two pairs, of those nodes with a certain constant probability P, right? So that's why the whole ensemble is characterized by two numbers, namely N and P. So that's the graph of, or the space or ensemble of graphs with N nodes and each of the O of N square edges appearing with probability P. Now, obviously, the probability that a given node has a degree of K is just binomially distributed, right? So you perform K Bernoulli experiments, like randomized draws, is the edge there or isn't it there, each with a probability of P. So the whole degree distribution will be binomially distributed, and we know that if we go with n to infinity and keep the quantity n times p fixed, then we can very well approximate this discrete probability distribution by the continuous probability distribution that goes under the name of Poisson distribution, right? So that's one way to approximate the binomial distribution. Another one would be if you plainly go with an n to infinity without keeping this quantity, this expected mean or expected or mean degree of a node fixed, then you can also approximate the binomial distribution with a normal distribution, with a Gaussian, okay? Now, the expectation of the binomial distribution is n minus 1, to be exact, times p. And this quantity we would often denote by z, and this is nothing else but the mean or expected degree of a node, right? So if you randomize out all the edges that a node could have, then you would end up with an expectation of z, right? And since this is a Poisson distribution, or at least the approximation is Poisson, this family of random graphs is called Poisson random graphs. Then we said, okay, in those, what we're interested in is what kind of properties does a given Poisson or other random graph model have or exhibit? And, we would say that this ensemble has a given property, then if for n going to infinity, the probability that the graph has the property goes to 1. So the property can be, is a giant component exists or is connected or whatever, right? And what we often see is that in such models we have things that in physics are called phase transitions. So that's a non-continuous dependency on the parameters. So for one range of parameters you have a certain behavior, and then bam, the behavior non-continuously changes. And this is formalized by this set of equations which we discussed. And one example for this behavior would be the existence of a giant component in such a Poisson random graph. And that was pretty much where we left off. So I'm going to quickly repeat our considerations there. And the math is just to demonstrate typical ways of thinking and calculating in this network science, right? And for those that are interested in network science, there's not only the survey article that I linked and put on the web for you by Mark Newman, but also the much more recent book by him, which is called Networks. And it's, I guess, from 2013, so pretty recent and very interesting, right? So if U denotes the fraction of nodes that do not belong to the giant component, right? Then this is absolutely equal to the probability that none of the neighbors of a node in question belongs to X, right? And well, for each of them, the probability that it's not in X is also U. So we get the functional equation U is equal to U to the power K for a fixed K, right? So that means that if we compute U for a non-fixed K, so taking into consideration all possible Ks, what we need to do is we need to sum up the corresponding probabilities. So remember that when calculating with probabilities, summing means logical and multiplying means logical and. So here we have a sum because we could have all possible cases for that fixed K, right? And so we know, and we then have to compute the sum multiplied with PK, obviously. We know PK, because that was what we just found out here. We can insert this and find that U is equal to E to the Z, and Z is the mean degree, times U to the U minus 1, right? Translating this into a equation for the fraction of the graph occupied by the giant component, we get this functional equation for this fraction, right? And this is a transcendent functional equation that you have to numerically solve. And this is what the result is. So that's that dotted line here. And we see that even for very small mean degrees, the probability that, or the size, I should say, the size of the assumed giant component very quickly approaches 1, right? So even for very moderate mean degrees of 3 or 4, we can almost be absolutely sure that a giant component exists, okay? So take-home message from that is in social networks where we have a mean degree of 100 or something, we can almost in all cases expect the graph to be connected, especially if we filter out newcomer nodes before we do our calculations, right? So people that just have registered to a social networking platform instance, then we can pretty much be sure that the whole graph is connected and only has one component, okay? So that is certainly something that we have. Another thing that we were left off with calculating is, for example, the property of the diameter, right? And one more word with respect to that. What we see is that this is a typical phase transition. So for mean average, mean degrees in the area between 0 and 1, we don't have a giant component, and that very quickly arises, right? So that's somehow a non-continuous behavior. So we don't have a smooth curve starting from 0 and smoothly behaving. It's a non-continuous phase transition-like behavior. And there are other properties of those graphs that are non-continuous as that, right? So that's why it's called a phase transition. Incomplete analogy to ice melting or liquid water evaporating, right? Good. So if we want to compute the mean average path length in such a Poisson random graph, what's the outcome? Well, if we take a very simple view and view the network basically as a tree, right, we can estimate that very coarsely, right? So if we assume the average degree of node or the mean degree is Z, right? Then in a distance D, starting from some node I, we should have approximately Z to the power D many nodes, right? So this would be a Z-ary tree, right? So at each level, each node is connected to Z others, and we don't have any back edges. We for the moment assume that it's a tree, right? And then we say that if the whole number of nodes is n, then in a distance of d, we should have z to the d equal to n many nodes, right? And if we denote d as l, so we're still thinking about the diameter of the graph, then a quick calculation shows us that l is O of log n, right? That's a very simple approximation, which assumes that, well, if I have 100 friends and each of them has 100 friends, then how many steps would I have to go until I reach the 7 billion people that are on Earth, right? So, and this turns out to be in the order of magnitude of log n, right? And, well, the take-home message from that is, as another property that seems to be very well reproduced by Poisson random graphs, another property of social networks, I should say, right? Because we saw that in very many types of networks, we will have this small world property of small mean average path lengths, and small means in this case that we speak of a small world if L is O of log N, right? Can we do that a bit more accurately, right? Yes, we can. And we see how this works later on, right? Now, you can ask yourself, well, why then are Poisson random graphs not a perfect approximation for social networks? The answer is because there is a slight problem with the clustering coefficient, okay? We remember that the first version of our clustering coefficient is equal to the probability of transitivity, right? So how probable is it that two friends of mine are also friends, okay? And since in this Poisson random graph model, the edges are drawn independently, right? It's clear that the probability of two friends being connected is just the same as me and a friend being connected, and all these probabilities are equal to P, right? Because they're independently drawn, right? And so they're all constant, these probabilities. And since we want to keep our mean degree Z, which is approximately n times p, right? Or n times p times n minus 1 to be more accurate, right? If we keep that fixed and go with n to infinity, we know that obviously p must go as O of 1 over n, right? So n goes to infinity, so p must go as 1 over n, such that z is kept fixed, right? And so we see that the clustering coefficient does not exhibit a constant behavior as in social network, but a 1 over n behavior. So for example, in the film collaborators network, we see that the other version, C2, which just behaves the same, roughly, right, has a value of 0.7, whereas in other types of networks, such as the power grid network or comparable Poisson random graph networks, we have a order of magnitude which is several degree orders of magnitude smaller, right? So here, this would be the film collaboration network of Hollywood. And if you compute a Poisson random graph model with the same N, right, which is large, comparatively large, then you would see this is several orders of magnitude smaller. And, well, this is something that is not in congruence with social networks. And why is this? So intuition tells you that it's much more probable that that two of your friends are connected than compared to the fact that they're not connected, right? It's simply something that experience tells you, and this is another way of formulating that the social world is much more clustered than the world of Poisson random graphs. Furthermore, so obviously the degree distribution, if we have K and here we have PK, is a Poisson function, right, with somewhere the mean degree being here. And this is not in, this is not congruent to the power law that we find in social networks, right? In social networks, we have a power law potentially with a exponential cutoff somewhere, right? So if we leave this out, anyway, I mean, this doesn't look the same. Yeah. So the degree distribution in a Poisson random graph is Poisson and not a power. Right. So this is a second thing that's not in congruence. Right. The Poisson random graph has random mixing patterns. So there is no such thing as assortativity or homophily, which we have in social networks. Remember the thing with the Hispanics and the whites and the blacks and this thing. Another property is that with local search, it is not navigatable. And we see what this means in the next lecture. And yeah, which is somehow something similar to the fitting clustering coefficient, it does not exhibit community structures. So we see that in social networks, we have hierarchies of communities, families and friends and colleagues and parties and Bavarians and so on, which is not the case in Poisson random graphs, right? Since they're randomly constructed. Good. So what's the way out? So there is attempts have been made to replace this very simple probability distribution PK by enforcing some probability distribution PK in the model. And these things are called configuration models. So you can say, I want a random graph with a power law, right? And that's certainly possible. However, it turns out that the respective mathematical results become much harder to compute, right? So these are harder models. And but still, these things don't produce networks that are in full congruence with real-world networks. There are still many difficult open mathematical problems. And foremost, so this transitivity problem, so the high clustering coefficient, is still not accounted for in these configuration models, right? That's why Duncan Watts and his co-worker Steve Strogatz came up with this idea in 1998, and they wrote a short article in Nature, which is, as you might know, the most reputed science journal in the world. So if you happen to have two or three Nature papers, you can almost be sure to later on get a full professorship somewhere at a reputed university, right? And Duncan Watts, interestingly so, is a mechanical engineer by education. So he's not even one of those networks physicists such as Mark Newman. He's actually an engineer, but that didn't keep him from being a brilliant network scientist. So, and he came up with, together with Steve Strogatz, with this small world model in 1998, right? And how does that work? So we start with L nodes, and they are arranged in a D-dimensional regular lattice that is equipped with periodic boundary conditions. So a toroidal topology there. So for the dimension being equal to one, we simply have a ring, right? Such as in cord peer-to-peer networking, if you want. And each node is connected to its neighbors in a regular fashion. So it's connected to all the neighbors that have a distance of at most k, right? So here in that ring, we see that if d is equal to 1, all the nodes are arranged in such a circular fashion, and we can get as far as 3, and there is still a direct connection to this, to the second, to this, and this, and this, and also in the other direction, right? So each node here for k equal to 3 is connected to 6 others, right? Good. Now, this is the thing to start, and that means that we have L, large L, times k many edges in that simple model. Now, what we do is we start to randomly rewire some of them, right? So you go through all of these edges that are regularly assorted, and then you rewire them to some random destination with a probability of P, right? And what you get is such a such an image. There are some of those. You see, here is one missing, right? That was originally from here to here. That now points to this node, okay? And for example, here there is this one missing that now points to this node, right? So randomly rewire the nodes. That doesn't seem to be a truly innovative thing, but as we will see, it solves the problem of clustering coefficient, right? Good. So this parameter P somehow controls the transition between this regular lattice that you start with and a complete random graph. So if you go up with this rewiring probability, if you go ever up, then at the end you will get more or less something that's very similar to a Poisson random graph, right? If you rewire everything randomly, then you'll end up at a completely random graph, right? So, for the two extreme cases, we can analyze what will be the result. So for a regular lattice, it turns out that the clustering coefficient is almost constant, right? So something linear in K, and K is not the a degree here. Yeah, well, it is the degree, it's connected to the degree, but the connection in the regular lattice to other nodes at a distance of at most K, right? This limits these local connections, right? So it's this one in the numerator is linear, this one in the denominator is linear, so the whole thing goes to a constant if the number of edges goes to infinity. So the clustering coefficient seems to be in okay correspondence to a social network. However, the mean average path length goes as roughly as 1 over k. Yeah. So if L goes to infinity, this is not in congruence to what we find in social networks. So we don't have a small world effect. Because for a small world effect, we would like to have L as something as log in L or log in K, right? So since L and K are related, we would like to have something like that. Now that's clear because if you want to go from here to here, you would have to take these steps, but in essence, you would have to somehow go around. And since the connection is always local, however large K is, if L goes to infinity and the ring gets ever larger, in essence, what you will have to do, you would always have to go around if you want to go to someone at the opposite side. So that's why why you don't have a logarithmic mean average path length in there, right? And well, that's clear because we're having a regular lattice. And what is the reason for this behavior that you have a small world is this randomized dealing out the edges in a Poisson random graph, right? So if you randomly do that, the result is actually a small world, as we saw. Now, for P going to 1 or P being 1, as I said, we're very similar to some random graph model. Now, the mean average path length is logarithmic, right? So we have the small world effect, but we see that the clustering coefficient goes as 1 over L, for L equal to infinity. So in the number of nodes, we would not have the behavior that we would like, but more something similar as in the Poisson random graph. So obviously, and you already have guessed it, the truth is somewhere in between, right? And this looks like this, right? And I'll explain this slide in a few seconds, right? So here, if we have a rewiring probability of 0, we would have the regular lattice. So there are two curves, right? So there is this solid curve, which is the mean average path length, and the dotted curve up here denotes the clustering coefficient, right? So for a regular lattice, we have a large clustering coefficient, which is what we want, in essence, to be similar to a social network, but the mean average path length is still too large, right? Whereas for the p equal to 1, the clustering coefficient is just too small while we are having a small world, right? So it seems to be that you just cannot get both. Well, you can if you're somewhere in an intermediate range. In an intermediate range, we see that we have a small world, so small l, while we're still retaining a large clustering coefficient, okay? And we will see why this is so and what this has to do with real life and our expectations about social networks. First slide here that I left out, so there are two variants of the original Watt-Strogatz model. First one is in the original Watt-Strogatz model, I only rewired the destination. If I chose an edge for rewiring, I only rewired the destination. Now, variant number one also rewires the origin of the edges. So that turns out to be mathematically a bit simpler to compute with respect to certain computations. And the other variant, which is even simpler, and that's what we are going to analyze, is that you do not rewire, but you actually just add edges with a certain probability, right? So you keep the lattice structure intact, and you only add these rewired edges. So these new edges here, and we would call them shortcuts for a specific reason, how many of them can we expect? So if we only add them, we know that there are L times K many in the regular lattice, and there are L times K times P added shortcuts, right? Because we add them with a probability of P. So the mean degree of each node would then be 2K, that comes from the regular lattice, plus 2K times P, that comes from the shortcuts, right? So we just add something, a little portion to each node. Now, why does that correspond to social networks, and why are these things called shortcuts, right? So if you think of a rural society, right? So everyone lives in his or her village, right? So in the ancient times, when traveling was very costly and people had to work very hard, you only knew your guys from your own village, right? So even the village in the neighborhood was a world far away, right? So you could marry either the priest's daughter or the butcher's daughter, and you can see whatever came in handy, but these were the only choices, right? And then, while being a bit more travel-y, you would get to know all the people in distant villages by these hub people, right? So there is one fancy guy in each village that knows someone else in the other village. And then we have this typical Osama bin Laden effect. So you knew everybody else in the other village via that person, right? And one of them even knows someone in Munich. Oh my God, the big city. Oh yeah. So everyone knew everyone else, right? By very few edges. And furthermore, so the local community structures were still preserved, right? So the regular lattice corresponds to something that is somehow similar to a world that's being organized in blocks, right? So the separate communities, and the shortcuts kind of mediate between those things, right? So the shortcuts enable you to navigate efficiently, while the clustering structure is still retained to a certain degree. And that's the beauty of this model, that it allows to explain both aspects, right? Now, we see that if we just compute that for the original model and for variant number two, the clustering coefficient in both cases is almost constant, because in the numerator and the denominator, we have expressions that are linear in K, right? So if we go with K to infinity, both variants would yield constant values, and that's in good congruence with the observed values, right? So let's calculate the actual degree distribution, right? So for the Poisson random graph, things were easy because we saw that was binomially distributed, right? So variant number two is the one where you keep the lattice structure and just add shortcuts, okay? Now, we saw that each node has 2k times 1 minus 1 plus p many connections if it has a degree k, right? So can we say something about the distribution? Okay, good. So obviously, since each node is in this regular lattice, the degree, and we will denote this with j now because k is already taken, okay? So that's not the degree k, but that's the distance k that was meant originally in the Watt-Strogatz model. Sorry, right? Now, if we denote the degree now with j, we know that each node has at minimum 2k many other nodes that it's connected to, right? Because that's the given thing from the regular lattice, okay? So we know that there is some probability to j minus 2k because for j being smaller or equal to 2k, these quantities should all be zero to enforce that. That's why in the binomial coefficient, we would not take L over j, but actually L over j minus 2k. Yeah, so to ensure that this boundary condition is actually met, right? And this probability in here, we will understand in a second. So here we have probability to j minus 2k and 1 minus the probability to L minus j minus 2k, right? So that's, again, something that is very binomial-like, yeah, because the thing is constructed by this in this random fashion, right? So P is defined such that the mean number of added shortcuts is then L times K times P. That is something we already had, right? And the mean degree, as we already wrote down, is 2K plus 2K times P. And these added shortcuts are clearly binomially distributed. Very simple, right? So this is this probability P tilde that takes effect here in this distribution for the added shortcuts, right? And we know that the expectation of such a binomial distribution should be L times P tilde. And if we resolve that, so 2k times p is L times p tilde, we get that p tilde is 2k p over L, and that's basically the probability that we have over here, okay? So in effect, this is just the binomial distribution for the added shortcuts, yeah? So in essence, this condition here ensures that this 2k is also respected automatically, right? So the mean degree distribution without the shortcuts is super boring. That's 2k for every node. And 2kp is the expected number of shortcuts for every node. And we must fumble the distribution together such that this is the result. And this is in congruence with this p tilde being 2kp over L. Right? If you look at this, you'll find this surprisingly simple. It's just that this is maybe irritating to ensure that j must be larger or equal than 2k. Yeah? Good. And this you can take as a basis for your computations in the Watt-Strogatz model. Right? So for the original model that does not add the shortcuts but rewires original edges, you'll find something slightly more complicated. Right, so you would somehow have to do a more complicated summation. You'll find a binomial-like term, but some more combinatorics in here, and this e to the minus pk. So that's, as you can see, slightly more complicated than this one, and that's why the variant 2 is much more popular, right? If you ask yourself, oh my God, what do I do with such formulas? In the end, I'm supposed to write an exam, right? I couldn't care less about the Watt-Strogatz model. I just want the credits, okay? That's perfectly legal. And my advice would be read the background reading, read the paper by Mark Newman, and try to understand qualitatively how you get this formula. So if you learn, obviously, if there's an explanation on the slides, you can conclude, okay, Groh thinks that this is somehow easy, so I should make an effort to understand why this formula is as it is, right? So understand the derivation of the formula as well as the statement of the formula, yeah? So this is just these types of things that are given without proof are just given for comparison. Right, so don't make the attempt, or I mean, if you want, you can make the attempt to calculate it, but you're not meant to really be able to do that. And if you look through the questions at the end of this slide set, you will find that my goal is always to check for a basic understanding of things, not for the full math, right? Not for all of the proofs. So it's the same with the chapter on plexes and cliques, right? So there were some things on the slides where it says that, okay, how can you see that this is NP complete, right? Reduce it to the satisfiability problem. Well, that's already for the interested students, I'd say. So the interested students should try to figure out how do you do this reduction. So most of you will. Do the game students already have theoretical computer science this semester? Yes, I think. So if you want to compare this to the stuff you do in complexity there, that's fine, right? So the master's students and the more advanced bachelors should already know that. And that's a nice to have. That deepens your understanding, but that's not required for passing, or not required for even for a good mark, right? So if I were you, the approaches are go through the slides, try to understand the statement of the formulas, and for the ones where a derivation is given or at least hinted to, try to understand how they work, right? And the result in your brain will be a much more networked understanding. And what I also want you to learn is this way of making derivations in network science, yeah, dealing with probability distributions and so on. And once again, for those that are not fit in probability theory, I scanned the respective pages from Bishop's book, should be about 40 pages or so, I don't know, and I linked them, I put them online in Piazza, right? Those that are not fit in probability, please read that. And those that still have questions, come to me and I'll be happy to discuss everything there, right? Explain everything, why is this, why is that, yeah? Cool. Now, if you plot that, this formula that we just derived for variant number 2, and if you do the Poisson approximation, you'd get something like this, right? Now, this is certainly not really what we want, because again, in real-world networks, we tend to have something that's more similar to power laws often, and this again is a Poisson distribution, right? So the Watt-Strogatz model cannot solve everything, but at least it solved the problem with the clustering coefficient, okay? Mean average path length is hard to calculate. However, what we see is that if we go with P to 0, so if we go in the realm of regular lattices, we would find something that is linear in L. So we don't have a small world. But if we go with P to equal to 1, we'd have a logarithmic distribution here. And in between, as I said, calculations are quite hard, where we'd have some characteristic functional equations that are guided by these extremal settings here, Okay? That's not to be understood in detail, right? So, if we compute this a bit further, right? So, we know that LKP is the mean number of shortcuts, and in our variant number two, we find that L goes as something L over K times a function applied to that expected number of shortcuts. And the functional form of F is determined by these rather lengthy calculations, which I want to spare you. So there's a lot of hyperbolic tangents and evil functions involved. However, we'd find something that in our medium realm, something that looks reasonable. Okay, good. Now that was the Watt-Strogatz model, and there's a lot to be read about this in the survey paper as a background reading, right? Now, all these things, so random graphs, Watt-Strogatz, and so on, all these models are aimed at reproducing properties of real-world networks, right? So phenomena that you find, and your task, your goal is to come up with a random graph model to reproduce these properties, right? But these prescriptions, how to compute random graphs or what Strogatz model, namely plot the N nodes and then randomly attach edges or don't attach them, or do a lattice and then randomly rewire, that's certainly a model to construct these random graph models, but it's not a real growth model for the network, because networks naturally grow, right? So, for example, Facebook has a social network behind it that grew from, let's say, 5 years ago to its current state, and we don't have an precise understanding how this goes about. And there are models that describe network growth, right? And we will want to investigate two of them, mainly the model of Price and a bit more coarsely the model of Barabashi and Albert, also very famous network scientists. So Barabashi became famous for his analysis of telephone networks, so call networks and cellular registration event type of networks. And, these guys are regular keynote speakers at conferences dealing with networks. I once heard him do a talk at SocialCom at MIT. So these are the guys that really know their stuff and do a lot of interesting research, right? And it's always the case in social computing that if you happen to have the data, then you're well off, because if the telephone company is so generous as to give you their call logs of 5 years for the whole world or something, then it's easy to write a good paper about this, right? And as you might remember, I don't know if he meant that really or if it was just a joke, one of them claimed to have all the credit card transactions of the US of, I don't know, 5 years or so. And, well, there's always this ethical side behind it, you know, NSA and stuff. So don't be uncritical with these things. Be aware of what you can do and what you can't do. And you know that you also, as every researcher, you have a responsibility to act reasonably and ethically there, right? Good. So what's a good model of network growth? Okay. So Price's model intends to describe the relation between a principle that also goes by the name of the rich get richer, or the Matthew effect, or a bit more scientifically, preferential attachment on the one side, and, for example, the resulting degree distributions on the other side. Okay? So what we start with is, we start with a directed citation network. Right, so the nodes represent papers, and one paper cites another paper, and these edges are directed because there is a clear direction of citations, right? So, as always, pk, the fraction of nodes within degree, this time k. Yeah. Now, our experience tells us that each paper has an almost constant number of citations. Why is that? Because conferences usually enforce the maximum number of pages. So typically, there is 8 pages, 8, 2 column, IEEE, something like that. And this corresponds to such and such a number of words. And on average, a typical scientific text has an almost constant number of citations. So in the end, you'll end up with like 20 to 30, I don't know how the exact number is, citations that every paper has. We can assume that this average out degree for each paper is constant, and we'll denote this as M. Now, naturally, each paper that is cited must be cited by someone. So the mean out degree must be equal to the mean in degree. Right, so we know that we'd have M on the one side, and we have K times PK summed over K on the other side, right? So on the inside, we're having this PK, and what we're computing here is just an expectation. K times PK summed over K is just the expectation, and on the other hand, we have just the M, because we're assuming that each node has the exact same out degree M, right? And what we now do is we simulate the process of network growth, right? So new papers appear, and new papers cite someone, and they are being cited by someone. And we would like to understand the mechanics of this, right? So let's assume this red, make this red assumption. So the probability of a paper to be cited, we will assume to be proportional to the number of existing citations of that paper, right? So if it's a very famous paper that has a lot of citations, then this is usually because people think that it's a good paper, or people tend to think it's a good paper, although they haven't read it because lots of other people thought that it would be a good paper. However, this is a reasonable assumption, right? Furthermore, if we do network growth processes that are governed by this assumption, and you already see that this is the rich get richer assumption, basically, right? The new papers would be very bad off, because if they are not yet cited by someone, the probability is simply zero that they will get cited in the future. So that's why Price's model assumes a simple starting credit. So by the fact that if the authors of a paper wrote that paper, they're kind of citing themselves, right? So that's why we start with an initial in degree of 1, right? Otherwise, we would have difficulties, right? So, now, this new paper that comes in has M citations to give out, okay? Now, what is the probability that any of these new citations attaches to any node that has an in degree of K, okay? So, obviously, PK is the fraction of nodes that having an in degree K, and we would want to have this thing realized here. So K plus 1, and this plus 1 is because of that starting thing here, K plus 1 is roughly the numerator here, and we would have to normalize this by summing over all possibilities that we would like to have here, right? So this divided by this is just the probability that we would end up at a node with a degree K. And this is linear in K, right? So again, this corresponds to a logical OR, right? So if we're having a fraction of PK many of these nodes, we would have K chances to cite one of them, right? That's why we'd have a factor of K. right? And this more or less implements what we have here. Now, summing over k, k times pk, we would know this must yield m, right? Because what is cited must have been cited by someone, right? And so we'd have this m here in the denominator. Good. So we know that each new paper has m citations to deal out, right? So the mean number of new in edges that go to nodes with a current in degree k is just this quantity here, this probability times m. Once again, yeah, this is a, the mean number of such new in edges that appear, right? Because we don't normalize this thing as in this thing here. So this is a probability, whereas this expression in total is a mean number of new in edges, right? Because we multiply this probability that we got here times m, yeah? And that's this new fraction. Now we're having a dynamical change, right? So a new paper comes in with its m suites to deal out, okay? Now this has some effect. Obviously, all the papers that had a degree in degree of k before are kind of, and they are cited, well, they don't have an in degree of k anymore, because they're now having an in degree of k plus one, right? So they had k suites, now they get one suite more, now they have k plus one suites, right? So this is this number decreases, while the other nodes that had other degrees increase, right? So the ones that had k minus one now have k, right? And this has to be formulated in a dynamical equation, right? So there's these two effects, right? So the mean number of nodes with an in degree k, they decrease because their new degree is k plus one. And the mean number of nodes with in degree k also increases because those that had previously k minus one now have k, right? This is just the dynamical process that goes on. Now, we know how many nodes with an in degree k we have, right? So we, before we had the new paper, we had n nodes, we had n papers, and there were n times pk many with a degree k, right? And we have a second index n that parameterizes this probability with respect to the total number of papers, right? Now we know that the net change, right, is now that we have n plus one paper, we know that the net number of papers with a degree k is now n plus one times pk, now with a parameter of n plus one, and we have to subtract those that had a degree of k before, right? So this is the net change. And we know that the net change is due to this effect and this effect. So the decrease is here denoted with this minus, whereas the increase, so the second process, is denoted with this plus here, right? And again, the formula is exactly this one, right? So we have it in a version with k, and we have it in a version with k plus one, right? If you look at this closely, right? So you always have these factors of m over m plus one, and now you have k, pk minus one, that's the increase from k minus one to k. And the decrease is from k to k plus one, right? And that's just what we described here. So this is the original one, and this is the one that we analogously transformed, right? So this is the net change in these quantities. And you already see that this is something like a recursion equation in N, that you can solve, right? So from discrete Strukturen, you know how to solve any recursion equation, right? And this is just for k at minimum being 1, and this is just the version for k equal to 0, simplifies a little bit so that there is a separate version, right? If you solve that, so if you want to compute stationary solutions for this dynamical process, in the end, what you would want to find, you would want to go with n to infinity such that these pk's are not dependent on n anymore, so that you would have this pure process for n going to infinity. And, oh wonder, what we find is a power law. Yeah. So this is the simple mathematical analysis. So the Matthew effect, preferential attachment, the rich get richer, leads to a power law distribution. And that's very interesting for socioeconomists, right, that investigate fairness of distributional effects in society, right? If it's really the case that rich, in terms of monetarily rich, people get ever richer by these processes, then we see that we would have a power law distribution in wealth, for example. And this is also the same for citations in science, right? So if you, for example, would like to appoint a new professor, and if you were ever in such a commission, people make attempts to kind of quantify how good someone is scientifically. In former times, they would just count the number of papers times the reputation of the respective conference of journal, which results in a number of indices of whatever sort. And now other people advocate that the number of citations is the real currency, because you can publish as many stuff as you like, as many papers. If no one cites them, they just don't have any scientific impact. Now, the new currency is citations, but we see that this is also problematic because, the rich get richer is not an effect that's solely, or that can solely be attributed to quality, but that's also a network growth effect, right? So Justin Bieber isn't that much more beautiful than you or you, right? He's just Justin Bieber. So this has an avalanche effect, right? He may be, I don't know, slightly in the eyes of 12-year-olds, I don't know. Yeah. But in the end, there's not effectively such a large difference, right? It's just a networking effect, okay? So as we can see, counting citations is also maybe a bit problematic. Good. Now, Arabashi's model was introduced to come up as a model for the web, right? So he would have liked to have undirected edges. And what we would do is nodes with a fixed degree of M are added to the network each time, and then we would have the same number, or a very similar type of attachment there. So the edges connect to nodes with a certain probability, and that's proportional to the current degree. And if you do an analogous analysis as for Price's model, we would also get a power law, albeit with a slightly different coefficient here, so k to the minus 3 in Albert's model. Right. For both, it's crucial that you have this linear preferential attachment. If you would say that the probability to connect to a new node is not linearly dependent on its current adjacent number of nodes, but let's say quadratically or cubically, then you get a very different kind of model. Right. So it's this linear preferential attachment that leads to these connections. And if you check this in real-world citation networks with real papers, real authors, real scientific fields, If you want, we'd have a large data set collected by one of my bachelor students, and also one that Christoph, the guy with the exercise, did his bachelor's thesis on. You can have that for analysis if you like. Now, good. There's also directed versions of Barabasi Albert, where you would have that the preferential attachment is proportional to the sum of out and in degrees, right? So it's not only that everybody likes Justin Bieber, but it's even more attractive if Madonna likes Justin Bieber, right? Okay, because, or anyone else that has a lot of contacts, right? Out degree. That is maybe not so realistic for the web, but you can discuss whether this is realistic for the social net, for a social network. Furthermore, so another problem is that in citation networks, it's clear that papers from the past cannot cite papers from the future, right? This is very simple because you can only cite what's there at the time you wrote the paper. So in essence, what you have is something like a tree or a DAG, which is not realistic for social networks, because in social networks, it's not a problem to have directed cycles, right? So this is why this is maybe not so much an ideal model for social network growth. And, well, the out degree of the web, which it was intended to describe by Barabasi and colleagues, is actually a power law. And in prices and Barabasi Albert, we find that it's constant, right? So this M that each paper can deal out. That's also not really ideal. So what we see is that all the attempts that are made to describe certain aspects fail at other aspects. And as far as I know, there is still no common overall model that would describe any aspect of social networks. So, and well, the reason, well, it's hard to speculate, but obviously there's a lot of complicated behavioral processes going on that form social networks, right? So the limitations in your social perception range and societal issues and issues of Maslow pyramid, basic needs, what do they dictate in terms of your job, your life rhythms, what do biological needs and biological truths and facts dictates that you have to sleep like 8 hours a day or a night, whatever, right? And these are all things that might play a role in there, right? Good. A whole different story. There's lots of other models that describe network growth, and you can read about them in the survey paper. But what I mentioned at the very beginning of this lecture is that also epidemiologists are interested in social networks. And why is this? Because if you're interested in the spread of diseases, you are also interested in the connection between the spread of diseases and the social network structure. Why is this? So the social network structure is fixed. I mean, you just cannot go around and randomly shoot people to avoid the flu being spread, right? But what you can do, you can, for example, find vaccination strategies. And if you take out nodes by vaccinating them, it's a bit more humane, right? Then you're able to set blocks for the spread of diseases. And that is something that we will very briefly look at. And this is often described by so-called percolation processes, right? And what you do in percolation analysis is you color nodes, right? Or in other words, you occupy them, whatever occupy means, right? So you just mark them in some ways and you randomly assign the state of being occupied or non-occupied to edges or nodes. And then you analyze both parts, so the occupied and the unoccupied parts separately. And what you would want in case of a vaccination program is that the unoccupied part would behave significantly different in terms of these network statistics as the occupied part, right? So then you can say, for example, if the unoccupied part doesn't have a giant component anymore, you could expect that the outbreaks of diseases stay local, right? And that was something that happened with the earlier Ebola outbreaks in Africa, because the society in Middle Africa was still so rural that the disease kept within, or could be kept within, villages or certain geographical regions. Almost all the people died, and then it was over, right? So it was like a quick nuclear attack, bam, and it was like that. But then nowadays, while African society is getting more modern and there's more travel, people would then go to Lagos and all the other cities, infect others, and then there is all these network effects that were previously not there, okay? Now, so when taking out nodes or edges with some pattern, we can ask for, again, network resilience. So resilience with respect to connectedness. Now, if we have such a configuration random graph model with a power law degree distribution, so not a Poisson random graph, but such a configuration model, we can investigate phase transitions with respect to the giant component when occupying nodes with a certain in a certain fashion. Okay, now let's investigate this very briefly. Right, so if the degree distribution is power law, we would want to denote the fraction of occupied nodes with Q. Right. So if we're having a vertex with degree k, if this is a given fact, so what's the probability of having k prime many occupied neighbors given that we're actually having k many? Okay. Now, if q is the constant fraction of occupied vertices, then this is binomially distributed. Okay, so this binomial coefficient, q to the k prime, 1 minus q to the k minus k prime. So the probability that any node is actually connected to k prime many occupied nodes is pk prime. So pk was a power law, now we're trying to compute pk prime under the assumption that we occupied a constant fraction q of the nodes, right? And this probability, in order to come up with this, if we know this conditional probability, we can apply the law of total probability. So this line here you can leave out practically, just cross that out. This should read p small k, right? And not p times k. I'll correct this on the slides, right? So just leave out that term. Now, the law of total probability is always, if you're having the distribution of two random variables A and B, right? It's very easy to get the probability distribution for A only, because that's just summing over all values B, which large B can take, right? That's simple summing out variables, law of total probability. And this is nothing if we insert the definition of conditional probability, which is just P of A given B is P of A and B divided by P of B. So we know that this would be sum over small b P of A given that B is b, small b times this prior probability for p being b, right? And this is precisely what we have here. And, well, this is the equation that we have to numerically or analytically solve, right? And if you do the same analysis as before for the existence of the giant component and this phase transition, you would find that if you are sufficiently, or if you have a power law that sufficiently fast, quickly falls off, right? So you have a sufficiently large, or I should say a small, a sufficiently small cutoff, or not a cutoff, a sufficiently small slope here, right? Then a giant component almost, yeah, exists notwithstanding the value for Q, right? And that's not what we want, right? In other words, if people have very many friends, then you can occupy as many nodes as you want, you would still have a connected giant component, right? If this falls off very quickly, right? So there are very few people with a lot of friends, then you have a chance to destroy the giant component with this percolation, with this occupying a fraction of Q of the nodes. But if people have very many friends, then you don't have a chance. And that's the thing here, right? And, well, it's the same with AIDS, right? If people have very many contacts, yeah, if the power law is not steep enough, then you can, well, spread condoms, cover the world in condoms, and it would still be an HIV epidemic, right? So fortunately enough, people seem to be not that amoral or whatever you want to call this. However, this is obviously how you can deal with these phenomena. Okay. Now, as in the discussion of network resilience, here we would just target random nodes, right? With vaccinations or distributing condoms or whatever, right? If you just address the people with a lot of contacts, right? So you distribute the condoms in places where you know there are a lot of people that have a large K, then this is much more effective, okay? So if you do that, you attack the nodes with large K deliberately. So now Q is dependent on K, right? Which, if you do the same analysis, yields that we'd only have to take out a small fraction of the high degree nodes to destroy the giant component. Okay, and that's good news. So if you should ever be in the position of planning a vaccination campaign for an infectious disease or any other countermeasure, try this strategy. Okay, and actually, how do you find the nodes with high degrees? Okay, now if you go out and ask the people, do you have a high degree, right? People will not answer honestly. I mean, if you just ask for the number of physical contacts and not intimate contacts, they would probably answer you honestly. But if in case of HIV, you're a bit stuck with this because no one will admit that, okay? Now, in this case, what people do is they randomly vaccinate not the people, but they randomly determine someone and vaccinate his or her, one of his or her friends, right? Or contacts. Because automatically, if you do that, you would target on average the people with a high K. Yeah? Because, yeah, taking out someone, for example, you, and then taking one of your friends or people that you know, and then you'd automatically arrive at people with a high K, because they're much more probable that you end up at one of those hubs, yeah, if you randomly do that, than with random targeting, right? Because with this one-step sampling, you would not get high degree ones, but you would just sample the original distribution. But if you would sample the friends, you would get the high degree nodes. And this yields that you would again need only a very small critical fraction of nodes to destroy the giant component, dependent on the exponent alpha, right? So with growing alpha, surprisingly so. So if alpha grows, it would be a steeper descent. This function just rises and then goes back down again. However, it stays below 0.03, right? So the basic story still is it takes not very many people if you target the high degree ones. Okay. Now, the classical way to describe processes on networks such as percolation processes or disease spreading is with the help of differential equations or systems of differential equations. But these systems of differential equations completely neglect the network structure. So that's the old way to do it. And for example, if you take a SIR model, then this goes as such. So we have three sorts of nodes. So there are the infected ones that have the disease. Then there are the susceptible ones that did not have contact with the agent, the virus, or whatever. And there are the ones that are recovered. And with recovered, we mean the ones that are dead as well as the ones that are actually recovered, which are assumed to be immune, because that's the normal process with most of virus infections. If you survive them, then you kind of have a lifelong protection with the help of a proper immune response, right? So these three sorts of nodes exist, and we assume that they are the set of nodes can be exclusively partitioned into these three sets, so they don't overlap, right? Now, if we have an infection probability beta and a recovery probability gamma, then this is the resulting system of differential equations, right? So the susceptible persons, the set of susceptible persons changes over time. And there's again two influences on this number, right? So first of all, right? So what we see is that this is directly proportional to beta, so the infection probability, but also to the number of infectious persons and the number of susceptible persons, right? So if there are very few infectious persons, then the net change in the number of S is also small. And if S is not large, then there is also not a large change. If there are a lot of infected people and a lot of susceptible people, then there is a high dynamics. So the number goes down, right? And why does it go down? So why do we have a minus here? Because S gets smaller while I goes up, right? That's the mechanism of infection. Now, the infected, and that was what I was originally intending to say, the dynamics of the infected people has two elements. So the number of infected goes down because this number loses to the number of recovered, because these are people that actually die or get healthy again. And it goes up because there is an influx from the susceptible ones that are infected, right? So we have two terms. So what is the loss here in numbers of S is the gain in terms of I. And what is the loss in terms of the recovered, or the gain of the recovered, is the loss in the infected, right? And both have to be multiplied with their respective rates. And this is a system of equation that you can solve for very many types of gammas and betas. So these can also have a priori probabilities. That's a typical Bayesian type of thinking. So these rates would not be simple numbers, but you can investigate whole distributions. And these distributions, again, depend on parameters, right? And you will find certain effects there, okay? Why ever this is the case and what this is, I don't know. It's decoration. Okay, good. Now, if we do the same things, right? if we do same things with the susceptibles, the infective, and the recovered, now on a network, right? And if we employ all the mechanisms of percolation theory, then we would find different results, right? Because now we not only have the betas and the gammas and the initial populations of I, S, and R, but also the network structure. And if we do that, we would find equations like that, right? So we see that the problem is, in fact, or we don't see it, but we can just accept it, that the problem is equivalent to an edge percolation problem, where the edge occupation probability is 1 minus this more or less complicated integral here. Okay. So these are typical factors that you would also know from statistical physics, like Boltzmann factors and stuff. They all look the same, e to the minus something. And then we have the prior probabilities for beta and gamma, and you'd have to do the integration, right? If you want to know more about this, it's also in the background reading. And what we would do with this knowledge is we would still want to investigate how the network falls apart into components when you do percolation, when you shoot down certain edges by vaccinating them or by other means like distributing condoms or something, right? And again, we're interested in the phase transitions, so in these non-continuous behaviors, because it can be the case if you vaccinate 1,000 people, nothing happens. If you vaccinate 1,500, the disease is gone, right? So you need to know where the critical points are to just be over them. And that's why you want to know about these dynamics. Good. Okay. So that was that. And as I said, how do you find high-degree nodes? Well, choose node at random and vaccinate some friend, right? This leads to a good strategy. And always the strategy, even on networks, will be to vaccinate the highest degree vertices, as we have seen. Now, network processes, and that's the last thing we will do today, can also be investigated with respect to searching on networks, right? So if you remember the lecture on centrality and the discussion on PageRank, Google's famous ingredient, then we saw that PageRank is characterized by the fact that a node is more central the more central nodes it's connected to. And that led to this eigenvalue problem without the heuristic corrections that we discussed there. So basically, the adjacency matrix multiplied by the vector of centralities should give back the vector of centralities scaled by the eigenvalue. Okay. Now, this kind of neglects directions. Now, if we look at this in a bit more fine-grained fashion, we would obviously have to differentiate between pages that are linked to by many other pages. These are pages that have a high indegree. And there are also pages that link to a lot of pages that have a high outdegree. Okay? Now, if we reformulate the idea of PageRank in terms of that, what we would see is that we would deem something an authority if it has a high indegree from highly outdegree weighted nodes, right? So it's an authority if it has a lot of in links. If you're linked, I'm an authority if many links point to me, but not from anyone. I'm only an authority if these links come from pages that are somehow hubs that point to a lot of good pages, right? So a hub is a node that has a high outdegree, but not to something, not a link farm or something, but a high out degree, two highly in-degree weighted notes. Now, if you formulate this in terms of the eigen equations, you would find that the adjacency matrix times y, and y denotes the out degree based weights that we want to find, so the out degree based centralities, while x denotes the in-degree based weights, we would find that A times Y is lambda times X, right? So that's just formulating this, and A times X is mu times Y. It's just the other thing, right? So instead of having the simple page rank, you now have something like a two-part page rank. Now, this doesn't do much, because if you insert one equation into the other, you would still get back a eigen equation, but now with respect to the matrix AA transpose. Okay? And I don't know why search engines, maybe search engines do incorporate this already, maybe they don't, but this would be a way to refine page rank a bit more. And what you can also do, you can also do the same thing as with the degrees. You can investigate this a bit more in terms of processes, right? Good. Now, another thing that you can discuss in terms of, well, these Google-level considerations, you can discuss this in decentralized search scenarios. Right, and remember the exercise where we talk about social search, right? So this is a typical decentralized way of searching. And if you would want to do that, so if you want to replace this, I crawl the network, I built an index, and I put out a service with a search slot as Google does, but instead perform a decentralized avalanche-like search, then you can go about in with various strategies. So you can do breadth first search, right? And ask each node, do you have the information that I want? And if it doesn't have the information, it can maybe guarantee you to forward it to its neighbors. So that leads to certain effects. But there is even simpler versions. And Lada Adamich, which is another famous network researcher, came up with this. So instead of asking all my neighbors, what I will do, I will ask them and they will answer me yes or no, but not only yes or no, but they will also answer me the number of their neighbors, right? I can instead of just doing breadth first, target the ones that have especially high out degrees, and then do the same as with this percolation, targeting the highest degree nodes. And then I have, she showed that in power law networks, I have a much higher chance of finding what I want. Okay. And other variants of searching will be discussed in the next lecture, and that will take place tomorrow, 8:15. See you then. Bye.